There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, scumbags. This is the Scummy Mummies podcast with your hosts, Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne.
Welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne.
And it's me, Ellie Gibson.
Ellie, I'm delighted.
Me too.
You know I love a sloppy seconds.
Oh, wow. It's a strong start.
What have I walked into here? Okay.
You've slipped in. No, I'm absolutely thrilled to have back one of our favourite guests. One of our most popular guests, in fact.
Yes.
Johan Hari. Hello.
I'm well chuffed to be here. Thank you.
Oh, yes. I know, because Stolen Focus, I mean, you've written many books, and they've all been very popular, but Stolen Focus was, it was mind-blowing. It was game-changing. And we did the podcast, and we had so many people get in touch saying how much they love the podcast, and then they went on obviously to buy the book. You're welcome.
If you're listening and you haven't listened to our first podcast with Johan, do you know what? I hate it when people go back and listen to that one, because I'm like, no, I'll fucking be the judge of how to spend my own time. Thank you. Don't tell me what to do. Maybe go and listen to it if you like. No, it's really good. And that was all about addiction to screens, wasn't it? And what it's doing to our brains and all of that. What's your new book about?
It's called Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. And it's about, you know, this new, completely new kind of drug that is causing staggering amounts of weight loss. Mm. What that's going to mean for all of us, the positive things and the negative things. And that's what it's about.
So you've gone from brain to body. Does that mean you're completely not addicted to your phone at all now? You barely look at it these days. You've just got a couple of yoghurt pots and a piece of string.
Exactly. I have a small bowl of dust. The phone is locked in the attic.
You know. And you have fun!
I snort the dust. And every now and then, take the phone out and throw it out the window and go and pick it up from the ground. And that's my pleasure in life.
Sounds gorgeous.
Exactly. It's a beautiful tale.
Such a good person.
But I'm always interested in whether people have sort of taken their own advice in the long term. Because I've certainly done lots of things in my life where I went, oh, right, brilliant. I'm going to do this forever now because this is really working for me. And then
this
a few
is the
years
new
later.
Me. I'm changed.
Yeah, it turns out. Actually, I'm shit at judo. What's your experience been like?
For that book, I mean, it was very important to me to not hold myself up as like, you know, there's a kind of genre of self-help where you're like, dear reader, I had this problem and I did the following 10 things. Right. And now you, dear reader, do what I did and you can be as much of a smug fucker as me, right?
That's a black belt.
that is absolutely not what I do, right? Partly because the factors that are harming our attention in the case of that book are these huge social factors from, you know, the design of our technology in Silicon Valley to the way we eat because of our food system to, you know, I mean, it's just a huge array of things, the way our kids' schools work. And obviously, no one individual alone can completely fix that. Together we can fix it, but we can't do that on our own. But there are lots of things we can do on our own that can help. And so my life is much better because I do a lot of the things that, you know, that I learned are helpful for individuals. So
is that having the phone in a different room at night, that sort of thing?
It's not just having a different room. I've got something called a K-safe.
I bought one, yeah. I've got it on the podcast.
She was influenced.
Yeah. She was influenced. But I haven't actually set it up.
set it up. There is no setting up. You put a battery in, that is it.
Just read the instructions.
Okay, well,
I threaten the children with it. So if anyone doesn't know K-Safe, as we did talk about in the last podcast, I told you to listen to it. It's where you can put things in this safe, obviously.
It's a plastic safe.
It has a timer on it. Yes, yeah, so you can see the things, and it has a timer, and it arrived, and I just sort of wave it at the children if I think they're having too much screen, and that seems to have done the trick.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it basically locks away your phone or anything else for anything between 5 minutes and a whole day, and once you've locked it, you can't get the stuff unless you smash it, and then you've got to buy another case safe. So I do that every day. I do it for 2 hours a day at least to do my writing. I've got on all my synced to my laptop and my phone an app called Freedom. So Freedom, say you were obsessed with Instagram, you can say to Freedom,
Helen,
imagining the right term to you there, Helen.
What are you talking about?
Why are you making me with your words?
So let's imagine a hypothetical person called Bellen, for example, who is addicted to Instagram. You can say to it, don't let me go on Instagram for the next 5 minutes, next 5 hours, however long it is. And then once you push the button, if you try to go onto Instagram, it will cut you off. It will just say, you've been set free, go and do something else, right? Mm. So I use that. I have all social media permanently blocked on my phone. I can sometimes look at it on my laptop, but it's always blocked on my phone.
Awesome.
So there's lots of things like that, and some bigger things, like I just went off the grid for 3 months to Jamaica. I mean, I appreciate that's not something that a lot of people can do. But so, yeah, there's a lot of changes in my life as a result of learning all this science about attention. But obviously, that's not enough. What we've got to do is actually, we've got to make loads of individual changes for ourselves and our kids. But we've also got to take on the forces that are fucking doing this to us, right? And that's the main thing we need to do. And a lot of the book, Stolen Focus, is about that.
Yeah. So, as I say, so that's your brain sorted. So
then, having entirely solved all problems relating to the human brain...
Right. And thanks let's again now, for doing that.
Very welcome. Let's now solve all existing problems relating to the human body.
Yeah.
And we'll do the soul for my third book, and then we'll... That's it. I can kill myself. Game over.
That's your trilogy.
Thank God.
Could we maybe start with, it's a tragic story, but it did make me laugh, the KFC story. Would you mind
I'm glad it makes some
story?
Fucker laugh. On Christmas Eve 2009, at lunchtime, I went to my local brunch KFC in East London. And I went in and I said to the guy behind the counter, I said my standard order, which is so disgusting, I'm not going to repeat it. And the guy behind the counter said, oh, Johan, I'm really glad you're here. And I was like, right. And he said, wait a minute. And he went off behind where they fry all the chicken and everything. And he came back with every member of staff who was working that day and a massive Christmas card in which they had written to our best customer. And everyone had written little personal messages. And one of the reasons that my heart sank is I thought, this isn't even the fried chicken shop I come to the most.
Sorry.
So I just, and it's funny, I didn't go back to that KFC for ages. And I bumped into that guy in the street maybe 4 or 5 months later and he said, oh yeah, and you didn't come back. We all thought you must have had a heart attack. Fuck me.
You think we maybe weirded you out of the card?
It was a really unfortunate experience. So it was basically my whole life.
If you do live to 100, you get a telegram from Colonel Sanders.
He finally reveals to you the 12 hidden herbs and spices, right? And then he kills you.
What do you know? He's in too deep. Oh, God. Sorry. Yes, yeah. No, it's a very sad story.
Well, that was my life, right? One of the, you know, I remember so vividly the first time I ever heard about these weight loss drugs. It was this really weird moment. It was the winter of 2022, and it was that moment when the world was just opening up again, right?
Yeah.
And I'd been shut away like everyone else. I hadn't been to a party in nearly 2 years, and I got invited to a party, and I thought, fuck it, I'm going. And on the way there, it was a party given by an Oscar-winning actor. And on the way there...
Oh, come on.
Well, this is relevant. Merely name-dropping. There is a reason why you need to know this piece of information.
My dear friend.
Exactly, yes. My beloved friend.
Larry Olivier.
I mean... I will discreetly tell you off-camera who it was.
Okay.
And on the way there, I was thinking, shit, I've gained loads of weight, right? Like everyone, so many people had during COVID. I thought, but this is going to be really interesting. They're all going to have gained weight. It's going to be fascinating to see them looking a bit podgier than they normally are, right? And I turned up and it was bizarre. Everyone wasn't just not fat or fatter. Everyone looked gaunt, right? They looked like their own Snapchat filters. They were sharper and clearer and leaner. And it wasn't just the actors, it was their partners, their agents, the agents' partners, people's kids, the writers. Everyone had lost a huge amount of weight. And I bumped into a friend of mine on the dance floor and I said to her, shit, looks like everyone really did take up Pilates during lockdown. And she kind of laughed and I said, what are you laughing at? She said, well, you know, it's not Pilates, right? And I just looked at her blankly. I had no idea what she was talking about. And she just pulled out her phone and Googled something. She showed me a picture of an Ozempic pen. And I obviously learned in the next couple of days much more about this. And I've never felt, I don't think in my life, so conflicted and divided about something as I immediately was about these drugs, right? So on the one hand, I could immediately see, okay, I've had this dysfunctional relationship with this food all my life. I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be because he died when he was 44 of a heart attack. My dad had heart problems. My uncle died of a heart attack. My other uncle had to have a pacemaker. Like, there's a lot of heart disease in the men in my family, on both sides of my family. And we know that obesity, sadly, on average, really harms health. And if we have drugs that reverse that, wow, that could be a real benefit. But I also immediately thought, well, we've seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. Every decade or so, a new diet drug comes along. It's presented as a miracle drug. Loads of people take it, and then we discover it has some horrendous effect and has to be pulled from the market, leaving a trail of like devastation in its wake. Also, I thought, well, we know why obesity has enormously risen. It's tripled in our lifetimes across the world, right? And that's not because something went biologically wrong with our brains. That's because something went catastrophically wrong with the food system. Mm. Surely the solution is to fix that, not to add an extra additional potential poison onto all of us. I also thought, God, we've made so much progress with body positivity. What's going to happen to that? I also thought, what's going to happen when people with eating disorders get hold of these drugs? So I immediately just felt so conflicted. And that's when I decided to write a book about it. And I ended up going on this big journey all over the world from Iceland to Minneapolis to Tokyo to interview kind of the leading experts, the biggest critics, the biggest defenders, the people who created the drug. And it was a really weird experience because I've never had this with a book before. I know vastly more than I knew at the start about the benefits and risks and what this is going to do to the whole culture. But I still feel very divided and conflicted about it. Mm. It's so strange to know so much more and still feel a weird mixture of great hope and great anxiety about this. It's peculiar.
Having, you know, read your book, but also being a person who was fat for a
while. Were you?
Yeah.
Because you don't look like you've ever been fat. That's so interesting.
I was 30 kilos heavier 2 years ago.
Really?
So after my divorce, I got super fat because obviously I ate lots and I lived off Deliveroo. And then when I was writing my book called Get Divorced, Be Happy, ironically, I was very, very happy because I was just living off fags and wine. And I went and had a health check and they said, you're on your way to heart disease, diabetes, you've got no immune system, da 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 da. And that was a big catalyst for change. I was over 100 kilos. So very slowly I lost 5 stone over 18 months. But I know what it's like to be looked at as a fat person. I know what it feels like to be the ache, and also my mum was overweight and my dad had heart disease and all those sort of things. But you know, that every day I had to make a choice to get smaller. Every day I had to make a choice to, but then yeah, I could have just injected myself and it would be a lot quicker. And I was kind of conflicted when, because obviously you confront that in the book, where it's like, well, why don't you just eat less and move more? And it's not as easy as that. You know, that to overcome an addiction to food and the way you have that relationship with food, either for comfort or, you know, as companionship, you know, friendship you have within food. As you said, chicken friend.
I always mistype fried chicken as friend chicken. When I was writing about, I was like, oh, shit, you don't need to be fucking Freud to decode that one, right?
Then they actually made me do a little bit of wee. Friend chicken. So I get it, and I also think, gosh, you know, if you spent every day battling, like every day you go to the supermarket, you think, but I could choose the lasagna or I could choose a boiled egg. Like those decisions, it's exhausting. But if you have something that, you know, that the drug that helps you I guess, not want food or helps you lose weight.
Well, how does it help you exactly? What's the science?
Yeah. Remind me to come back to Helen. There's loads of fascinating things in what you just said. I want to ask you a few things about it. But
let's make this about me for a minute.
Ellie's turn.
So
this throuple is working out really well.
The way the drugs work. So one of the fascinating things about these drugs is that actually there's a big debate about how and why they work. But so there's a few things we know for sure. If you ate now anything, so we just ate some delicious food that you made for, what is your sponsor called? Let's give them a plug.
HelloFresh,
which actually was genuinely very nice.
Don't say it, now you're surprised. HelloFresh food is always delicious in my experience, Johan. Hashtag ad.
Buy HelloFresh immediately, everyone. What we do know, if you ate now, your pancreas would create a hormone called GLP-1, which is a natural signal in your body saying, Ellie, stop eating now, you've had enough, mm-hmm. right? But that natural GLP-1 only stays in your system for a few minutes and then it's washed away, right? It's gone. So you could, if you wanted to, you could eat again then without feeling that sort of biological pressure to stop. What these drugs do is they inject into you an artificial copy of GLP-1. Mm-hmm. But instead of being washed away in a few minutes, these drugs stay in your system for a whole week, which has this really weird effect. So I remember, obviously for the book, I took these drugs. And I remember the second day after I first injected myself with them, I woke up and I had this really weird feeling. And I was lying there, I was thinking, "What? There's something really weird here. What is it?" And it took me literally about 5 minutes to realise I've woken up and I'm not hungry. I don't remember that ever happening to me before. I would normally wake up and I'd be ravenously hungry. And I was that morning, kind of on autopilot, I went to the cafe up the road that I used to go to every morning, and I ordered what I would always order, which was a kind of big brown bap with lots of chicken and mayo in it. And Tatiana, the lovely Brazilian woman who works there, brought it over to me, and I had like 3 mouthfuls and I was full. I just didn't want to eat anymore. And I remember when I left, her calling after me, being like, are you okay, right? Mm. And then for lunch, I went to next to my office, there's a Turkish restaurant. And I went and I bought the thing I always bought. It was a Mediterranean lamb. And again, I had like 2 or 3 mouthfuls. I just didn't want any more. So one of the things that happens when you take these drugs is you feel very full, very fast, and you don't feel inclined to eat very much, which is why on Ozempic, also known as Wegovy, it's the same thing marketed for different purposes, the average person loses 15% of their body weight in a year. Mm. On Mounjaro, which works on 2 gut hormones, both GLP-1 and another one called GIP, you lose on average 21% of your body weight within a year. And for the next generation that will be available from next year probably, Triple G, which work on 3 gut hormones, you lose on average 24% of your body weight, which is only slightly below bariatric surgery. So one of the things that was striking talking to all the experts on this, including some of the critics, was this is a game changer, right? Mm. This is a new kind of drug working in a new way that really does deliver massive amounts of weight loss. So it's a very striking phenomenon. I mean, you can see I am like 3 stone lighter than I was, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a huge effect. And obviously I wanted to understand, okay, what are the risks and benefits of that?
I mean, what are the risks and benefits?
I teed you up perfectly to ask that question. You see the genius manipulation that I'm capable of?
What is it actually made of then, the drug itself? Like, I'm trying to visualise it. Does it come in like a big, like, comedy-like syringe, like a yellow fever injection, or is it like...
Yeah, so someone arrives at your house with massive rubber gloves. Yes. You will lie down now and be inject your now.
Hattie Jakes comes in.
Exactly.
On your side. Pulls your pants down. Exactly. Yeah, is it painful injection?
So I'm a total wuss about needles, and this is the thing I was most worried about. You can get them as pills as well, and pretty soon most people will be taking them as pills. But no, it's an EpiPen. So it's a tiny little EpiPen. And you twist a little needle on the top. It's a tiny needle. You can jab it into your leg or your stomach.
Yourself. Yeah.
You just jab it into your leg, push the button top, it clicks and it goes in. It's less than a mosquito bite. It's almost nothing. You don't feel it. I was very nervous at first, but it's the actual injection itself is very, very minor. But in terms of the risks and benefits, so if we want to think about the benefits, I think it really helps to think about a comparison with bariatric surgery, because up to now, you know, a very small number have been able to do what you did, Helen, and lose enormous amounts of weight through diet and exercise. But that's actually very unusual. So we don't have, weirdly, we don't have that much research on these people. What we do have good research on for drastic weight loss is bariatric surgery.
Mm. Right? Which is that the same as stomach stapling?
Stomach stapling is one form of gastric surgery. So bariatric...
The lap band or the...
Yeah, there's four kinds, but bariatric surgery is basically where they operate on your stomach to make it much harder for you to continue overeating, right? And there's various forms of it, but stomach stapling, that kind of thing, they're all examples of it. And bariatric surgery is fucking horrible. It's a horrible, grueling operation. 1 in 1,000 people die during the operation, so it's risky.
Yeah.
But the reason why people take that extraordinary risk is because of the absolutely staggering health benefits. So if you have bariatric surgery, in the next 7 years, you are 56% less likely to die of a heart attack, 60% less likely to die of cancer, 92% less likely to die of diabetes-related causes. In fact, it is such a dramatic effect on your health. You are 40% less likely to die of any cause at all if you have bariatric surgery.
Because you've lost so much weight.
Because obesity is, and I'm afraid this is a difficult truth, and I found it quite frightening to absorb, but obesity is stunningly bad for your health. Even things like...
I thought thinking had changed on that. I thought with the body positivity movement, when the whole thing was... you can be fat and healthy.
So unfortunately, the body positivity movement is right about a huge number of things, right? They are absolutely right that stigma is a disgusting, hateful, cruel form of bullying, mm-hmm. right? Mm. So 45% of women who have a BMI higher than 35 get insulted every single day, right? And they're right that firstly, that's just a form of bullying and hateful cruelty, yeah. and mm. we should oppose it on those grounds alone.
Absolutely. Mm.
But also, it's a catastrophic tool to promote change. If I make you feel like shit and make you hate your body, it doesn't make you want to take care of your body more,
no,
right?
No.
So they're absolutely right about all sorts of key concepts. There's a smaller part of the body positivity movement that argues not just against stigma as a form of cruelty, but argues that pointing out the health risks of obesity is itself a form of stigma and we shouldn't do it. And unfortunately... every major medical body in the world, I mean, points out that, you know, the evidence that obesity is profoundly harmful for your health is as strong as the evidence that vaccines work, that global warming is caused by man-made emissions. There's a body of science that has been really misinterpreted. I read really closely into health at any size because I wanted to... I'm open-minded about this, right? I'm very happy to challenge medical consensuses if they're wrong. So it's a health at any size movement. What it finds is, basically, you're better off if you're severely overweight, focusing on improving your health, so trying to eat better, move more, and feel better about yourself, than you are focusing only on losing weight, right? They're right about that. Mm. That you have, if you study people, the people who focus on improving their health rather than just weight loss...
So diet, as in with the quality of the food you eat.
Exactly, yeah. That kind of thing. They're slightly better off. But what's happened is that insight, which is important, and I agree with, and is true, has been misinterpreted, and lots of doctors said this to me, as you can be healthy at any size, right? And of course, you can be, in the same way that my mother smokes 70 cigarettes a day, and there she is, she's alive and well, and she's 78. But most smokers, sadly, don't have those odds, yeah. right? Unfortunately, the science on this is very, very clear. Now, that doesn't mean it's anyone's fault that they became obese. In fact, I was fucked over, and we were all fucked over by the food industry.
I'm trying to think how you hear that and not feel bad about it. You know, like I'm just worried about people listening to this.
Mm.
It is frightening, but I suppose that's what it is. Is that what we're saying?
Well, I think everyone listening will have had the experience of not wanting to hear bad news. Mm. You don't open the bill you can't pay. You don't answer the call from the doctor. But most of us... no, ultimately you'll be better off if you hear the bad news. Now, the reason why a lot of people don't want to do that is because up to now there hasn't been a good solution, and it may be these drugs right. are not a good solution. And there are plenty of people who argue they're not, and they have many good arguments on their side. But one of the people who really helped me to think about that argument in particular was an amazing woman called Shelley Bovey. You should have her on the podcast. She's a great person. So when we were kids, right, we're all the same age. When we were kids, the fat people on television were just depicted as a joke, right? It just invariably, I think about Bella Enberg, you remember her, people like that, Hattie Jakes, right? Who hated, actually, that she was being constantly fat-shamed, and it really depressed and angered her. And she was a genius actress and never got to really play the roles she could have. And the first time I ever heard that being challenged was weirdly on Kilroy, do you remember? Mm. So, it was a kind of...
For people... An injection that makes you thin!
It was actually that. It had on this woman, I think it was Kilroy. What was the other one on ITV that was on just an hour later? I don't know what it was called. John Stapleton, that was the host.
Oh, yeah.
But so I heard this woman, Shelley Bovey. So Shelley grew up in Port Talbot, working class steelworks town in Wales. And she was the only fat girl in her school in the 60s. And when she was 12, one day her teacher said to her, Bovey, stay behind after class. So she stayed behind and she was thinking, what have I done wrong? And the teacher said to her, you are far too fat. Go to Matron, she'll sort you out.
Oh my God.
So she goes to the matron, who I'm now picturing as Hattie Jakes, but I'm sure it wasn't. And she said, and the matron said, why are you here? And she said, well, the teacher says I'm too fat. And she said, take your clothes off, I'm going to inspect you. She takes her clothes off, and the matron said, yeah, she's right, you're far too fat. This is disgusting, you're a pig. And just berates her and tells her, eat less. So Shelley leaves, obviously feeling completely humiliated. And this humiliation just goes on all the time. The girls at the school are constantly telling her, God, thank God I'm not as fat as you. I'd kill myself if I was as fat as you. One day, it's literally something from a Roald Dahl story, a teacher saw her eating a second dessert in the school canteen and said, oh, you're such a pig, and made her eat like 10 desserts in front of them until she threw up, right? So you can imagine, this makes her hate her body. Mm. She never looked at her body naked because she hated it so much. She felt really ashamed. Her teachers thought she should apply to Cambridge, which was a big deal for a working class girl. Well, it would be now, and certainly was then. And she just didn't apply to... She actually got an offer from a different university. And then the night before, she's like, I can't go. They're just going to fat shame me. It's going to be horrible. I can't go. And all through her life, she's soaking up this just horrendous abuse, right? When she was pregnant, she went to the doctor. And the first thing the doctor said to her was, well, you shouldn't be pregnant when you're as fat as you are. When she gave birth, she had a very difficult birth. She's lying there, you know, covered in blood, and the midwife said, you know, you really need to lose some weight, right? When her baby couldn't feed, she went to the doctor, and the doctor said the baby wasn't attaching properly. The doctor said, well, what are you trying to do? Make the baby as fat as you are. So you've got to understand this constant abuse.
Yeah.
And of course, throughout her life, she just thought, well, this is what I'm meant to get, right? This is just my life, right? And she learned that in the US there was this movement called, it wouldn't have been called body positivity then, they called themselves Fat Pride, who were saying, fuck this, we're not taking this anymore, right? And Shelley wrote the first book in Britain that challenged this disgusting prejudice. It's called The Forbidden Body. Really good book, it stands up really well. And Shelley became the first figure to really pioneer body positivity in Britain, did incredibly important work on it. And a couple of years after that, Shelley was 50. She went to a doctor. She weighed nearly 20 stone. And the doctor said, look, you're having heart problems, right? What you were told, Helen.
Mm.
One day she went to Centre Parks with her kids and she just couldn't walk anywhere. And she was 50 and she was losing her mobility. And she's suddenly in this horrendous dilemma because she's like, I passionately believe everything I said about opposing stigma. And she wanted to write, at the time, there was a kind of a newsletter for this movement called Fat News. And she wanted to write about this. And they said, oh, no, you can't write about that. We're about the positive things. And there were other women who wanted to write about having diabetes, the challenges of it. And they were like, no, this is for positive stuff, right? And Shelley was really conflicted about this because she's like, it seemed to her then, well, we have to be able to do two things. We have to be able to challenge the stigma that harms overweight people. And we have to be able to talk about the health harms. And she said to her, that seemed like, those are obviously twin. They're both forms of self-love and self-protection, right? She would have died if she hadn't paid attention to that. Now, in her case, she did what you did, Helen. She did extreme calorie restriction. She lost an enormous amount of weight. And she kept it off for, you know, she's kept it off for all these years. This was in the 90s. And now she's very conscious that's very hard to do. But Shelley said to me, it's not an either-or thing. Either you're against stigma or you're in favour of helping people lose weight if they can. She said, what we've got to have is both and, right? Where possible. Now, of course, you oppose stigma across the board. It's hateful. And you can also, especially now, given we've got this tool we really need to think about, and think about in a lot of detail, about benefits and risks, I think if we're not weighing the benefits and risks, because people think there are no risks to being obese, then I think we have to, with a great deal of love and compassion, point to the absolutely overwhelming scientific evidence on this, because it is really, could not be more unambiguous. Mm. Of course, there are exceptions. Of course, there are people who are obese and live to be 95 and are perfectly healthy. But that statistical outliers don't disprove a general trend, unfortunately. I wish that wasn't the case, right? We wouldn't face these difficult choices if that wasn't the case. But I do think we have to level with people about that. And it's not loving them to pretend there aren't some painful insights here.
Mm. It is really confronting, because there was a big Cancer Council UK advertising campaign that just said obesity. And there was a big backlash by the body positivity movement saying we feel shamed by this. But I think CR UK came back and said, well, this is the evidence around it. And it is a really confronting thing, especially I remember when I had my 40-year check, I was 100 kilos, so whatever that is in your old money. But I hit all my health targets. So she's like, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just very, very overweight. So she didn't say you're on the path to obesity. I mean, your path to diabetes or anything. But in terms of like my blood pressure and all that, so there was no signs that I wasn't a healthy woman. But if I'd stayed that weight, my health, yeah, when I was 42, that's when I had the thing in it. And it turns out it wasn't great.
So that was the second health check at 42 that said actually...
Yeah, but that was something I did through a friend of mine who was a private doctor.
And I think one of the really sad things about that campaign is that, the way that campaign played out, is that the actual message got lost, which is Cancer Research UK explained. So when you carry excess weight, and it doesn't have to be that much excess weight, it was another thing that really shocked me, that fat doesn't just sit there, it's not inert, it's active, it sends signals in your body. And one of the signals it can send is for your cells to divide more rapidly, which can cause cancer. It's why, sadly, obesity makes you much more likely to develop cancer, right?
So then for the decision for you then to go on Ozempic, was it just a health thing? Because I think you write in the book about one of your friends was like, this is vanity, isn't it? This is about losing weight.
So what I consciously thought when I was working on the book, you know, I was thinking about the heart disease problems in my family. I was thinking about the fact that I had really tried through diet and exercise to lose weight, and I was never able to sustain the weight loss. And also I was writing the book, and I thought it's a bit weird to write the book if I don't try it.
Yeah.
And one of the most difficult, I had some really difficult conversations in writing the book. Like, she was getting really pissed off, and she was being sarcastic and narky. It's very unlike her. She's not overweight, so it wasn't like personal sensitivity. And one day, it must have been about 9 months into working on the book, she came to London. She doesn't live here. And I was talking about some of the big worries around eating disorders in young girls that related to these drugs. And she just fucking snapped. And she said, I'm sick of hearing you talk about this. You keep talking to me about, oh, you're weighing these benefits and risks. It's bullshit. She said, you were never that fat. Yeah, your grandfather had a heart attack in the 1960s when the world was completely different, right? And we'd had much worse healthcare. She said, let's be honest, when you're talking about all these risks for these young girls with eating disorders, the risks for your own health, and there's lots of them that we can talk about from the drugs, you're not doing this for your health, you're doing it for vanity, right? Mm. She said, "You, all the time I've known you, you've never been happy with the way you look. You're doing the way she put it to me is you're not doing this for your heart, you're doing it to get cheekbones, right? And she said, just be honest with yourself. And I was kind of arguing back, and she said, tell me honestly, if these drugs gave you all the benefits for your health but gave you boils on your face, would you use them? And I thought, shit, I definitely wouldn't, right?
I mean, no one wants boils on their face.
No, but I think she's got a good point. I don't agree with that. I think ultimately...
If she said arse, I'd be like, yes.
But I think there's lots of complicated things going on here. And not least that a very large portion of the people using the drugs are not doing them to reduce or reverse obesity because they weren't obese at the start, right? Mm. So you think about that party I went to. None of them were obese at the start, right? They were taking it to go from being slim to being super slim, which obviously incurs enormous health risks that we can talk about, particularly to muscle mass. So I do think she was I think she went too far. She was dismissing too much my genuine dilemma. But I think she did force me to confront how much of my motivation was about internalized shame about being fat, in addition to the genuine health concerns. And that's something that I think will be playing out for everyone, right? Everyone who's ever been fat. Mm. Almost everyone.
Because I think, you know, just from experience, shaming someone or putting them down does not motivate them to lose weight. In fact, you think, well, if people hate me, I may as well have another cake. You know, that I was fat shamed from a very, very early age. And I, it's only in this last couple of years that I haven't felt great disgust to my own body, and that's something new. But when I was with a very toxic person who never complimented me about it, I was never motivated to lose weight, because I thought, well, he doesn't love me or doesn't desire me anyway, what's the point? You know, I may as well be fat, I may as well be a bit miserable.
And there's lots of research that your experience sadly is very kind of representative. So there's lots of ways in which stigma harms health. Firstly, if you feel bad about yourself, you comfort eating more.
Yeah. And all your cortisol and all the stress hormones.
Exactly. You're flooded with cortisol.
Cannot lose weight. Yeah.
Secondly, there's a very good, Lindy West, a very good body positivity advocate, said, you know, why do we think making people hate their bodies will make them treat them better? You can't take good care of a thing you hate. If you're constantly soaking up that shit all the time, it means that when people come along with genuine health concerns, you can very often just hear it as more abuse, right? And I completely understand why, right? In the book, I go through, I'm just thinking about the thing you were asking much earlier, about the benefits and risks, right? So we were talking about the benefits, right? So when you reverse obesity, you improve a staggering array of health outcomes. And we know that. So people taking these drugs, if you started with a BMI higher than 27 and you take these drugs, over the next few years, your chance of a heart attack or stroke goes down by 20%, which is obviously something that was literally close to my heart as I was thinking about this decision, right? So those are the benefits. They're pretty fucking substantial, right? So obviously I was looking at what are the downsides, what are the risks? And we know the history of diet drugs, right? In the 90s, a diet drug was released called Fen-Phen, and it became unbelievably popular. There were 18 million Fen-Phen prescriptions in 1995 in the US. And then it was discovered that it had horrific effects on people's health. It caused a condition called primary pulmonary hypertension, which is where the blood vessels in your lungs dramatically contract and you can't breathe properly. It caused heart defects. Literally tens of thousands of women, their health was destroyed. Many of them died. It led to the biggest payout in the history of the pharmaceutical industry. They had to pay out $12 billion in compensation to the families of the people who died and other people who were harmed by it. So, obviously, I'm thinking, right, can you really get a free lunch or a smaller free lunch if you're taking these drugs, right?
Just what, a side salad.
What's the side salad of primary pulmonary hypertension?
Very simple.
Special K. Yeah.
What are the risks here?
What are the risks? Yeah.
And so, what the defenders of the drug say, and they've got a really good point here, but I'm going to get to a big caveat to it, is they say, look, we've actually got quite a lot of long-term research on this drug, medium to long-term, because as a lot of people will know, in addition to reducing your appetite, when you take Ozempic or Wegovy, it stimulates the more creation of insulin in your pancreas. And obviously for diabetics, what they're lacking is insulin. So it's used as a treatment for diabetes. And it's been on prescription now for 18 years. People have been getting Ozempic for diabetes. So they say, look, we've got 18 years of diabetics using it. Okay, it's not exactly the same. They're not using it to lose weight. Right. They're using it for diabetes. But if there was some horrific effect, like there was with Fen-Phen, we would know by now.
Yeah.
But when people said that argument, lots of people said, okay, well, let's go back and look at the diabetics to check you're right.
Oh, no.
So, for example, there's a guy I interviewed called Professor Jean-Luc Faye, who's a professor at the University Hospital in Montpellier in France. So he was asked by the French Medicines Agency to basically assess the safety of these drugs. And the French are in a really good position to do that because they've got incredibly good medical databases. You basically can't really opt out of them in France. So what he did is he looked at a huge number of diabetics who'd taken these drugs for 3 years or more, between 2006 and 2016, and then compared them to a similar group of diabetics who had not taken these drugs, right? To see, are there any differences? And what he found is pretty shocking. The people who had taken the drug saw an increase in their thyroid cancer risk of between 50 and 75%, right? Now, he was looking for thyroid cancer risk because we know that when you give these drugs to rats, they're much more likely to get thyroid cancer. Now, it's important to understand what he's not saying, even if he's right and that's disputed. He's not saying if you take the drug, you have a 50 to 75% chance of getting thyroid cancer. If it was, they'd immediately pull it from the market.
Yeah.
What he's saying is whatever your thyroid cancer risk was at the start, it will, if he's right, it will be increased by between 50 and 75%, right?
Right.
Now, thyroid cancer is relatively rare. 1.2% of people get it and 84% survive. But it's a pretty big increase in a relatively small risk, right? That's one of many risks that may be emerging, right? But again, one of the things that was so difficult about doing the research for the book and learning all this and thinking it all through and the complexity of it is you always have to be weighing these competing risks. There's Dr. Shauna Levy, who's a brilliant expert on this at Tulane School of Medicine in New Orleans, said to me, we don't know the long-term risks of these drugs. We do know the long-term risks of obesity, right? And what you've got to compare in practice, most people who don't take these drugs will continue to be obese. So you've got to compare them. So you compare that increased thyroid cancer risk, for example, to the increased risk of cancer just from obesity, which, as we said before, is very significant. So anyone who's talking about these drugs and is either saying, rah, rah, they're great. Everyone who's overweight, go on them today. No problem. Nothing bad to see here. Start taking them. I don't think you should trust those people. I also don't think you should trust the people, or I think you should be sceptical of the people, I put differently, who are saying, oh, they must just be evil and terrible and there's no benefits and don't take them.
Yeah, there is no magic pill.
The truth is, it's really, really complicated. Or even think about, so I called it magic pill because there's three ways in which, there's three kind of meanings of magic, right? So these drugs could be a magic pill in the sense they could just solve the problem so dramatically that it feels like magic. You're like, wow. And there's moments when I feel like that, right? It's like, wow, I eat dramatically less. I've lost loads of weight. I feel much better. And all I did was jab a little needle into my leg once a week, right? There's days when I feel that feels like magic to me.
Be even better if Debbie McGee came around and did it.
Fucking Debbie McGee, where is she? And the, I want the corpse of Paul Daniels and Debbie McGee immediately with every free pack, free with every pack of Ozempic.
Putting a rabbit out of your stomach.
Exactly. But so that's one sense of magic. Another sense of magic could be, and you can't debar this, it could be like Fen-Phen. It could be like a magic trick, right? It could be an illusion where actually it turns out to fuck you over, right? We don't, you can't rule that out. I don't think it's the most likely scenario, but you can't rule it out. And the third way it could be like magic is you think about every kind of classic story about magic, like Fantasia or Aladdin. You discover something magical, you make the wish with the genie and you get what you want, but it's never quite in the way you wanted to get it, right? And the magic spirals away from you in ways you could never have predicted at the start. And I think there's all sorts of ways in which this transformation, and bear in mind, 47% of Americans want to take these drugs, right? So we're talking about, and in Britain, it won't be that much lower, especially as the price comes down. There's ways in which this magic could run away from us and cause all sorts of unintended effects that are part of the 12 risks that I write about in the book. So it's complicated and there's a lot we don't know and there's a lot of the complexity that we need to think through to really get our heads around this. But we can't run away from it, right? It's coming for us. We will all know. I mean, Professor Graham McGregor, who's a professor of cardiovascular medicine here at, in London at Queen Mary University, said to me his prediction was that, you know, a few years from now, 30% of people in Britain will be on these drugs, right? So we're talking at 20 to 30%, he said. So we're talking about a huge number of people. It's going to change the economy. It's going to change the way we think about our own bodies, even if we're not taking them. It's going to affect young girls in particular in ways that really worry me. There's all sorts of things going on here. I really think we need to think it through very carefully.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Definitely.
Yeah. So obviously, you've talked about all these issues and some of the issues we haven't had time to talk about, like the eating disorders issue and things in your book, which is brilliant. And but I guess bottom line, I want to ask you, if a friend came to you today and said, should I take a Ozempic, what would you say?
Literally happened to me yesterday. So so I want to stress, I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. People should discuss this with their doctors. They should go through.
I'm just asking you anecdotally. Yeah, yeah. I'm not asking your medical professional.
Yeah, yeah. So, but having now interviewed all the leading kind of experts about this,
because I can't be bothered to. So, what to do, please
fix this, Johan.
What I would say is, if your BMI and agree, BMI is imperfect for all sorts of reasons that you alluded to, Helen. But if your it does have some validity. If your BMI is lower than 27, definitely do not take it. You're incurring all the risks with none of the benefits because you're not reversing obesity because you're not obese, right? If your BMI is higher than 35 and you don't have thyroid cancer in your family and you don't have a history of eating disorders and you're not trying to get pregnant, I would say, I would personally recommend that you take it because the risks of that ongoing obesity, in my view, which many reasonable people would disagree with, would outweigh the risks of these drugs. If you're in between, you've got BMI between 27 and 35, I think it's much more up for grabs and you should really go through the 12B risks that I write about in the book and the many benefits that I write about in the book and really reckon it through that complexity through yourself. And I mean, it tells you something about my judgment that I'm going to continue taking these drugs. Mm. So for
so how
me,
long have you been on it now?
A bit more than a year.
Yeah.
And because in your book, you say people who go off it, what's the risk of putting back the weight?
Almost the vast majority of people regain the weight within a year, most of their weight.
Right.
So is this a lifelong thing for you, do you think?
I don't know. Mm. It's like, so the way the drug companies present it, although of course they have a vested interest in this, is they say it's like statins or blood pressure medication.
Yeah.
It works as long as you take it. And then when you stop, it stops working. I don't know is the honest answer. I have made a lot of changes in how I eat. Because for the first 6 months, I was just eating smaller portions of the same old shit, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of humiliating to realize I had so few skills related to food. So I learned to cook. I've started, you know, I definitely don't want to present myself as a foodie or anything. But like, I've tried to make these changes. Honestly, I don't know. But for now,
I still eat fried chicken.
Weirdly, and this is a big debate, right? I don't. I took my godsons to KFC and I didn't get anything. And they said, who are you and what have you done with Johan Hari? Right? But one of the big debates about these drugs, which we kind of alluded to, is how do they work? And actually, one of the kind of emerging areas of the science is actually most scientists now think it works predominantly not on the gut, but on your brain. You have GLP-1 receptors in your brain.
Oh, right.
It changes what you want. It changes how you think, which is obviously feels to me like a much bigger change. Taking something that changes your gut doesn't feel that dramatic. Taking something that changes your brain for your whole life, taking it for your whole life, brings up a whole different set of risks. It's one of the reasons why there's concerns about depression and suicide in a minority of people taking these drugs. Again, very disputed, but plausible scientists saying it. It's why it's being investigated. So the honest answer is I don't know. And I feel quite conflicted about it, but I don't eat fried chicken. And I suspect that is because of a brain effect. My food preferences have profoundly changed in a way that seems really odd to me. If you had ever told me there'd be a time in my life where I would be turning down KFC, I would have thought you were, you know, fucking crazy. Right. Mm. So And it's not that I want it and the drug makes me feel sick. I don't want it. And that's what's so... That's one of the things that people who are taking drugs, it's very widespread, describe as so strange. Mm. It changes your preferences over time such that you don't want the shitty food in the same way. I'm not saying I don't ever want shitty food.
But
I sometimes
do. Like, this is... You know, your desire for it has changed, but do you... You know, that's a physical craving, but is there a romanticism, or is there, you know, because you knew you once loved it? Or
I'd say it's slightly different. I had a day, so I was in Las Vegas, I must have been 7 months into taking the drug, and I had a bad day. The book I'm writing about Las Vegas is related to the murder of someone I knew, so I had this rough day, you know, investigating it. And really on autopilot, I went to a KFC that I used to go to all the time in Vegas. It's on West Sahara. And really on autopilot, I ordered the thing I would always order. And I was sitting there and I had it in front of me and I looked at it and I just thought, shit, I can't eat this. I thought, oh, I'm just going to have to feel bad. And one of the things that's so interesting about these drugs, and one of the things that was hardest for me, is when your eating habits are so profoundly disrupted, what they do is they bring to the surface the underlying psychological drivers of your eating all along. I actually think it's probably, we don't know this, so this is my hunch, it's probably the main reason why some people are becoming depressed or even suicidal on these drugs,
yeah.
is that it's taking away the drug that you used to soothe yourself and manage your emotions all your life, right? It's you cannot comfort eat when you're on these drugs. You can't stuff yourself. You can't, you know, you can have a little bit of a sweet thing, but you can't stuff yourself. Mm. And when that is taken away from you, it's really hard. It's really difficult. And so I don't miss it in the romantic sense. I don't miss it in the craving sense even. Mm. What I missed for a long time and still miss is the psychological function that the food performed for me.
The habitual sort of... Yeah.
Exactly. And there are lots of other underlying psychological reasons I go through in the book, why people eat that emerge. Some people who've been sexually abused almost deliberately make themselves overweight to protect themselves from sexual attention and find it very disturbing when they lose weight on these drugs. I interview people in that position. Some people, they reenact their childhoods the whole time through food. Mm. You know, some people get a huge amount of pleasure from food, which is slightly different to comfort eating, sort of a bit connected, but different. And when that pleasure is taken away...
Yeah, that's me, you see, that's what I'd worry about.
And there's a lot...
Love eating.
That's one of our pillars of our friendship is Ellie and I...
I'd say it's the main one.
Yeah. So, well, if it wasn't for that, you'd be fucking out of here, you bitch.
Right? You see how we looked at each other over that meal.
But that's interesting, because I had a weird relationship with that as well, because... So most people who take the drug, it drains their pleasure in food and they don't like it. Even one of the people who designed the drugs, Jens Jules Holst, says, look, most people just can't take that over years and years and they stop taking the drug. Mm. Like Jay Rayner, who's a brilliant food critic, you probably know him, writes for The Observer, you know, described going on his Ozempic. He would go to the best Michelin-starred restaurants in Paris and just couldn't get any pleasure out of it, which for him was a nightmare. I think I'm quite unusual, but for me, it actually increased my pleasure in food, admittedly from a low base. And when I started taking these drugs, I realised how much of my eating was actually stuffing myself. So stuffing is where you deliberately eat very quickly to get a feeling beyond fullness, right? We all have that feeling of being stuffed sometime, like, and you feel that pressure upwards on your esophagus, outwards on your stomach. And for me, going right back to when I was quite young, I realised now that was a very soothing physical sensation for me, stuffing myself.
Yeah, see, I don't like that. Yeah.
Right, and most people don't, but like as minority people do. And on these drugs, I can't do that. I would just vomit if I tried to stuff myself. And what that meant is actually for me, it really slowed down my eating. So I am actually tasting the food a bit more than I used to. I'm a million miles away from being a foodie or anything like that. But so slightly for me, it has increased my pleasure, but it's sort of basically from no pleasure at all to a tiny little bit of pleasure. But... Yeah, I suspect for you it would be unpleasant. I mean, not that you obviously don't need them anyway, but like if you, you know, if someone who took as much pleasure in food as you do, I think that would be a real downside. It's one of the things we have to weigh against the benefits.
Yeah, I think it'd make you, food is joy. And also cooking for people, like the whole rich, you know, it's one thing about eating it, but the other thing is like making it for people and having lots of stuff to have that. Yeah, there's... What is very good is that because it is so complex and there's so much there, people can just buy your book.
They can buy the book.
They can just buy your book.
It's a miracle.
It's all there.
Do you ever listen to a podcast with someone and go, oh, I don't need to read the book now, but actually I'm like, oh, I just want to read the book again. There's so much.
Thank you.
Huge congratulations to you. It's just another brilliant book. And but it'd be one of those, I think you're right, we're on the cusp of something huge, aren't we, in terms of...
Essentially, Barclays Bank commissioned this very sober-minded financial analyst to look at, like, what will this mean for investment in the future? Mm. She said, if you want a comparison point for these drugs, you've got to look to the invention of the smartphone in 2007 for the explosive effect it's going to have.
Wow.
And all, if we were sitting here talking the day Steve Jobs unveiled the smartphone, the iPhone, we would not have been able to game out fucking TikTok and Trump and all the kind of catastrophes that have flown from it. It's all sorts of complexities coming down the way, but we can glimpse a lot of it. I meant to say on my publisher's taser me that if you want to know where to get the book, you can go to magicpillbook.com. You can get it as an audiobook, ebook, or physical book. You can also find out what your previous guest, Philippa Perry, said about it, and Davina McCall and Stephen Fry and lots of other people. I meant to say you can get it from all good bookshops, but you can also get it from shit bookshops as well. We don't have like a test. I was a bit bizarre.
Can you get it from a Poundland?
Not yet.
I will be in Poundland by the end of the week.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? It's a glimpse of the future. Bits of this podcast will be played on a Netflix documentary in 25 years. It'll be amazing.
When they'll be like, be played by the emaciated stick creature humans who come after us. What were they talking about? That's for why I imagine that stick insects would have that voice. It's just not the voice in Thunderbirds, isn't that a picture? Ooh.
And then it cuts to the ex-chief executive of SlimFast going, and that was when I shat my chest. It'd be amazing.
It's when I shat out my four remaining calories.
Now, very quickly, do you have a Scummy Mummy's confession for us?
I'm going to start. So, I was out for a run, but I forgot to take my keys. But I forgot that. And I was running back home to do just weeds, really. And I couldn't get into my house, so I had to piss in my own garden.
Oh, that's lovely.
I know. I thought I'd share that. I haven't peed in my own garden since COVID.
Oh.
But Ellie used to come to my house and pee quite freely.
I love a wild wee.
She does love a wild wee.
I haven't done one for a while, actually. There's been no need.
I beg you to do it after I've left. I actually get weirdly grossed out by this.
Like, where do you want it? Absolutely no problem.
She's very good at it. And it's not my comfort zone, as Ellie will know. But I had no choice.
The last great wild wee I did, in fact, I think the last one I did was a year ago, Helen, at the bottom of Mount Everest.
It was indeed, Ellie. Oh,
get you glam person.
Minus 25. Golden memories, as they say, of golden showers. Johan, have you got one?
I was thinking about, as we were talking earlier, about my infinite visits to McDonald's and KFC. And I remember one when my niece, Erin, is now 19, when she was six, I took her to McDonald's and she had a Happy Meal. And at the end of it, she said, Johan, can I have another Happy Meal? She grew up in the north. And I said, oh, Erin, you can't have another one. It's not good for you. And at the top of her voice, she said, Johan, don't be such a cunt. And I said, Erin, you can't, because my mother was looking after her. My mother's Scottish and says that word constantly.
Oh, right.
And I said, Erin, you can't say that word. She said, if you don't want to be called a cunt, don't be a cunt. And I was like, and I got the dirty, and it was a McDonald's in Kensington as well. I got the dirtiest fucking look.
Princess Diana was probably in there.
Exactly. The ghost of Princess Diana was weeping. No, Diana would have loved that. Yeah. Diana would have loved that.
She would have loved it.
She would have been delighted.
Oh, her and George and Freddie are up there now.
Exactly. Chortling. Exactly.
God bless them.
I'm sure it's a very interesting question. Did Princess Diana use the C word? I'm certain she did.
Oh, she was one. She was cheeky, I reckon.
Yes.
Oh.
Let's do a séance. I'll challenge Diana. And let's find out if she was foul-mouthed.
Yes. Exactly. Oh, she was definitely foul-mouthed. It's just the C word. That's the...
Oh, that's... Yes.
That was the original title, Cunt Hole in the Wind. But...
Hey!
Yeah, it's changed. Well, it's been so lovely.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've just got a magic pill to come back.
Magic Pill is out now. We're on tour. You know, scummymummies.com. That's where all the dates and the tickets are and all the things, if you like that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's it. Follow us on Instagram. We're at scummymummies. Where can people find you?
If they go to www.johannahari.com, they can see all my books. They can see where to get the audio books.
In the show notes.
They can see my social media, although I never look at it. That's how I had this really weird experience at the height of COVID. I was interviewed for this podcast, and it was the interviewer was a man in his 50s, and he said to me, what's your, Facebook? And I said it. What's your Twitter? And I said it. And he said, what's your Snapchat? And I said, I'm a 45-year-old man, right? The only 45-year-old man on Snapchat are definitely paedophiles, right? Why else are they there?
Yeah.
And he didn't laugh at all. And I've got this bad thing where if I make a joke and someone doesn't laugh, I lean into it. And I said, do you know that? He was an American. Do you know that show, To Catch a Predator, where they sort of catfish paedophiles? I said, the next season of To Catch a Predator should literally just be they go up to adult men in the street and say, what is your Snapchat profile? If they've got one, fucking throw them in the van. They're definitely paedos. He didn't laugh at all. Later, after the podcast came out, my friend Googled him. He's a very active person on Snapchat.
Oh, no.
So now my bar is to get through every podcast without accidentally accusing the hosts of being pedos. So I'm glad I succeeded this time.
Congratulations.
Yeah, pedos.
Oh, shut it, you big nonce.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Hooray. Yeah. Thank you.
It's been a delight.
Happy days.
And lovely. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye. Bye.
Goodbye.
Until next time.
You cunts.
Yeah, pedo cunts.
Pedo cunty nonce.
Hooray. Oh, that was Princess Diana who recorded that last bit.
She's still with us.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.